Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
It's an honor to be here. In September 1945, the British journalist Rebecca West was commissioned by the New Yorker to report on the trial of two British fascists who had thrown in their lot with Germany during the Second World War. The first of them was William Joyce, known as Lord Haw-Haw, a notorious broadcaster of German propaganda into Britain during the war. The second was John Amory, the son of former Secretary of State for India Leo Amory, who had formed the British Free Corps with the intention of fighting alongside the Germans on the Russian front. Both of these men were hanged for high treason. But as Rebecca West was sitting through these proceedings, she realized that she had the basis of a book called The Meaning of Treason, which was published in 1947. Now, this book is mostly a chronicle of the flawed psychology of traitors, people who, in her view, had acted against their better selves and their best interests by turning against the countries which had produced them. But she was also interested in the flawed psychology of states because she felt that they risked mirroring the flawed psychology of traitors by becoming over preoccupied with treason, by becoming over preoccupied with the problem of national security. By imposing draconian laws, by engendering a climate of fear, by jettisoning civil liberties, they too would be working against their best interest, the things that made those societies so valuable. And she said, the traitor can turn the community into a desert haunted by fear. If we do not keep before us the necessity of uniting care for security with the determination to preserve our liberties, we may lose our cause because we have fought too hard for it. In other words, the worst betrayal a society could inflict upon itself is sacrificing justice for security. Well, I would like to look today at two courts-martials, one here in Delhi, the other in Tokyo. The first of these here in Delhi is the Red Fort trial, convened in November 1945 to try members of the Indian National Army, the INA, for the charge of treason. Now, the events that were addressed at this trial had begun some 4 years earlier in Singapore on the 14th of February 1942, the day after General Yamashita's 25th Army had broken through the British lines and had compelled General Percival to surrender Singapore to the Japanese. The British and the Australian troops were immediately marched off to internment camps and prisons such as Changi and Seletar. But the Indian troops, some 40,000 of them, were not. Instead, they were convened at a place in Singapore called Farrer Park and were there addressed by a Japanese officer, Colonel Fujiwara. And Fujiwara gave these troops a stark choice. They could either take their fate as it came as prisoners of war for the duration of the war, or they could join the newly constituted Indian National Army and fight against the British alongside the Japanese. And according to the trial records, some 20,000, half of those troops, took the option of joining the INA. Now, the INA's most important incarnation was under the leadership of Subhas Chandra Bose, who, as many of you here know, was initially a very senior Congress politician, later left Congress, and in 1943 arrived in Singapore. And when he arrived in Singapore, he immediately announced the formation of the Provisional Government of Free India. And as this government subsequently declared war on the United Kingdom and the United States. Now, after the war's conclusion, the British decided it was necessary to settle accounts with the Indian National Army, the armed force that had been constituted in Singapore and had seen action around the Irrawaddy Valley in Burma and also in the Indian states of Manipur and Nagaland. So shortly after the War's Tribunal, the British decided it was necessary in order to maintain the discipline and order of the British-run Indian Army, it was necessary that they should be held to account. And so they convened the first of a series of court-martials of various INA officers and men. The first trial was by far the most important, and it brought to trial three defendants, Shahnawaz Khan, Prem Sehgal, and Gurbash Singh Dhillon, from amongst commanders of the Indian National Army. All three of them were charged with waging war against the king, the equivalent of treason that was set out in section 121 of the Indian Penal Code. Now, at first, this seemed to be a very straightforward case of treason. The prosecuting counsel, Sir Nauseam Engineer, immediately informed the court in his opening speech. He said, joining with rebels in an act of rebellion makes a man a traitor. But Engineer faced a very significant tactical problem, because in order to establish his case of treason against the INA, he had to present evidence of its existence, which had been carefully, scrupulously removed from the news by British wartime censors. And so in the process of presenting situation reports, orders of battle, supply manifests, intelligence assessments, arms inventory, staff lists, diary entries, witness statements, Engineer managed to conjure up victories and defeats, retreats under fire, captures of arms, casualties in battle. And in the process of setting out his case for treason, Engineer transforms a ghost army, a chimera, into the real thing. Now, of course, this had an electrifying effect on Indian public opinion. And because what it showed is that Indians under the nose of the embattled imperial authorities had formed its own tens of thousands strong army, commanded by its own nationals, which had fought and sometimes beaten the British. And as a consequence of this, this galvanized an already aroused independence movements, and because the three defendants happened to be Hindu, Sikh, and Muslim, even temporarily united that independence movement across communal lines. In other words, a trial which had been conceived by the British to convey a condemnatory effect had precisely the opposite outcome. Now, it is in this febrile atmosphere that the Chief Defence Counsel, Bullabai Desai, took the floor. And in the course of 2 days, he delivered a speech without notes that effectively turned this case upon its head. His argument was that the issue at hand were matters for public international law, not British Indian penal law. He argued first that the INA was a properly constituted and self-governing army run by Indian officers with its own disciplinary code, ranks, uniforms, and regalia. Second, it had two clear aims, the liberation of India from British rule and the protection of Indian populations in Burma and Malaya. It was not, as the prosecution claimed, a Japanese-run fifth column. Third, the provisional government of Free India, which had been proclaimed in Singapore in 1943, was a properly constituted government with command over resources and territories, including the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, which had been ceded to it by Japan. And fourth, that these characteristics amounted to statehood. Statehood which had been recognized by Japan and by Burma, Croatia, Manchukuo, and Siam. It was this state that had then declared war on Britain and the United States and had therefore acquired the rights of a belligerent within the framework of the laws of war. So the INA and the Provisional Government of Free India were, according to the defense, operating within the bounds of public international law. And this court in Delhi had no jurisdiction over those relations, and therefore the defendants had no case to answer. Now, in the course of making these arguments, Desai returned repeatedly to the question of allegiance that was at the heart of the trial. This issue had risen in the very first minutes of Engineer's opening address, and it resonated throughout the proceedings. Engineer had stated The offence in question is committed against the duty of allegiance. This allegiance is owed to the Crown at all times and in all circumstances. So as far as the prosecution was concerned, this violation of allegiance was twofold. First, that they had consorted with the enemy, and second, that the three defendants who were former British Indian Army officers had renounced their oath of allegiance to the King Emperor and had sworn a new oath of allegiance to the Provisional Government of Free India when joining the INA. So let's just step back and look at the idea of allegiance. In the common law tradition, of which of course India is a part, this idea arose out of feudal traditions, and it assumed that the relationship between the subject and the sovereign was perpetual or eternal in the relations between the sovereign and the subject. Take William Blackstone at the beginning of the early modern era, writing in his commentaries on the Law of England, 1765. He argued that the monarch and his subject were bound by social ties from birth, the monarch offering protection and the subject offering allegiance. Blackstone said, "Natural allegiance is a debt of gratitude which cannot be forfeited, cancelled, or altered." In short, once a subject, always a subject. And this was Engineer's point. Engineer channeling Blackstone, as we recall, says that subjects were bound to the Crown at all times and in all circumstances. By the 19th century, though, the idea of allegiance was beginning to erode, and especially at the behest of the United States, which was becoming increasingly enmeshed in cases where American citizens of immigrant stock might visit home, whereupon they were picked up and prosecuted for changing their citizenship. So to avoid these entanglements, in 1868, the Americans passed the Expatriation Act, which renounced this idea of perpetual allegiance and removed the completing claims of other states to the allegiance of a citizen who had changed their citizenship. But that said, that only applied in peacetime. It did not apply in war. It did not then, and it does not now. A citizen cannot renounce their citizenship during a war if they happen to dislike the policies of their own country, or if they're involved in treasonable activities and wish to seek a safe haven in an enemy state. And this case, the case that really crystallized the significance, the continuing perpetuity of allegiance in wartime, was the case of an Australian-Irish MP called Arthur Lynch. He had fought on the side of the Boers during the Boer War. The British picked him up for treason. Arthur Lynch said, "No, but I'm a citizen of the fledgling, about to become Republic of South Africa." But the British tried him for treason anyway. So at the Redfort trial, the problem faced by Desai and the defense team was how to find a legitimate, non-treasonable exception to the duty of allegiance during a war. And consciously or not, they gravitated towards a much older argument, advanced three centuries earlier by none other than the British jurisprudent and political theorist, Thomas Hobbes. Now, Hobbes was a firm believer, a firm advocate of the authoritarian smack of sovereign power. Had not human beings rushed out of the state of nature in fear of their lives, had not those human beings covenanted between themselves, agreed that they would abdicate their rights to a sovereign in return for the sovereign protecting their lives. So he makes these points, but he is, as well as being authoritarian, also intellectually rigorous, and he accepts that there may be an exception for this, and he sets out this exception very clearly. The deal is that the sovereign protects the lives of its subjects. So what happens if a sovereign is no longer able to do that? Say, for example, if the sovereign has been defeated by another state, or the subject is held as a prisoner of war. In those circumstances, the subject is perfectly within their rights to renounce the covenant and their allegiance to the sovereign. So it is this argument that has been picked up in the Redford trial, this argument. And so consequently, what you see is repeated comments by the witnesses and the defendants that indicated this very specific event, the event in Farrer Park in Singapore in 1952, the handing over to Colonel Fujiwara, that absolved them from allegiance to the British. Indeed, one of the defendants said, "I did not desert the British. The British deserted me." So the very loyalty which was so peremptorily commanded by the Raj under Section 121 and so summarily punished if abandoned was, could be, and was legitimately renounced. Well, these arguments being put forward by Desai were effectively turning the trial inside out. He was challenging the very premise of treason from inside a treason trial. And he made the point really clearly that the old imperial public international law had passed. In the old days, a subject race would remain in perpetuity a subject race because it could not engage in legitimate war for the purpose of liberating itself. But he said that modern public international law had moved on and had recognized the justice, or rather the injustice, of compelling Indians to fight on, for England's freedom against Japan, but not for their own liberation. So he was asserting the right of a struggle against colonialism. Well, this was all very persuasive to Indian advocates and to the independence movement. It did not sway the tribunal judges, however. They found all three defendants guilty of waging war against the king, and they sentenced them to transportation, which was, in effect, life imprisonment. They were staring down the Indian independence movement, but riots ensued, and a mutiny, and the British blinked. The British blinked, they decided they were going to commute the sentence, the confirming officer, Claude Auchinleck, reduced them to cashiering and forfeiture of arrears of pay, and the lesson that might be drawn from this, pace, Rebecca West, is that the British had gone too far. They descended into the situation described by her as the desert haunted by fear. They had tried to cool the incipient embers of loss of morale in the British Indian Army and had only thrown petrol on the fire of the nationalist struggle. Which takes us finally to another trial, another court-martial in Tokyo, to deal with an internationalized form of treason against the security, not just of one state, but of the society of states. The court was the International Military Tribunal for the Far East. The defendants were Japan's wartime leaders. The charge was crimes against peace. The charge that had been summoned from thin air by the Allies immediately after the conclusion of the war. And the most compelling critic of the crimes against peace charge was the Indian judge Radinabad Pal. Radinabad Pal came from being rector of the University of Calcutta. He was imbued with the consequences of the INA trial. He was aware of Desai's arguments. He had also been present throughout half the night with student demonstrators after a student demonstrator had been shot in Calcutta. So he knew all about the symbolism and the nationalist arguments that had accompanied the trial. So what he did is he questioned, and I will conclude here, the existence of a genuine international community united by common interests and capable of offering real alternatives to war as a method of resolving disputes. Pal, too, had a Hobbesian view. He believed that the international system was the kind of dog-eat-dog world that one might find in the state of nature. And he said that in the absence of this international community, states would continue to pursue their own partisan national aims by force of arms. So the Allies' motives for creating the new charge of crimes against peace were highly suspect, because it simply propped up what he called the very status quo maintained only by force, by pure opportunist have and holders. In other words, the powerful states against the colonized states. He also mentioned there was another good reason to be suspicious of crimes against peace. And he drew attention to a comment made by Robert Jackson, the chief American prosecutor at Nuremberg, who claimed that, and I'm quoting, "Whatever grievances a nation may have, however objectionable it finds the status quo, aggressive warfare is an illegal means of settling those grievances." Well, Powell saw that for what it was. It was effectively a call for the paralysis of international affairs and, by implication, the criminalization of the struggle against colonialism. Well, he considered this to be far too high a price to pay simply for peace. He said that the dominated states cannot be made to submit to eternal domination only in the name of peace. In other words, justice before security. Well, this, of course, was pure Desai. And before Desai, it was pure Mohandas Gandhi. Mohandas Gandhi opposed the 1928 Kellogg-Briand Pact, compelling states, suggesting that states renounce force as their national policy. He said, whose peace is that pact defending? It's their peace, not ours. And after Gandhi, it was pure C.S. Jha, who after India's invasion of Goa in 1961, told the Security Council, it must be realized that this is a question of getting rid of the last vestiges of colonialism in India. Charter or no charter, council or no council, that is our basic faith. So justice, again, trumps security. And what better illustration of Rebecca West's injunction against the security at all costs approach? They renounced crimes against peace almost as soon as the Tokyo trial was over, and soon after, many of those Asian states acquired their independence. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.